First of all, before we proceed with our first two cases, just for the record, Chief Justice Chris Pickering has recused from participation in the first two cases here today. And so we'll be, Justice Perry is not participating in the first case, is recused on that. He will participate in the second case this morning then. Okay, let's go ahead and call our first case, which is case number 62489, Las Vegas Sands Corporation versus District Court. Mr. Jacobs, you're a party in interest. Mr. Morris, you may proceed on behalf of the petitioner and the judge who serves in the time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Your Honors, may it please the Court, I'm Steve Morris. I'm here on behalf of the two petitioners, Las Vegas Sands Corporation and Las Vegas Sands China. I have read and am going to address the two questions that you promulgated, Chief Justice, and I'm happy to do so. And I think they fit very nicely into the argument I had planned before I saw the questions. Mm-hmm. In preparation for this argument, I would like to take 12 minutes and reserve three for reply. I would like to put this matter in context. In August 2011, this court ordered Judge Gonzalez, the district court, to stay the proceedings and to conduct an evidentiary hearing to determine whether Sands China is subject to jurisdiction in the United States or in Las Vegas. That hasn't happened yet. We've not had such a hearing. The hearing that brings us here today occurred in September of 2012. It was a sanctions hearing that was generated sua sponte by the district court. The hearing was held on September 10, 11, and 12. And it focused on, and this writ petition focuses on, a former lawyer for the Las Vegas Sands who was called by the court as a witness and examined by the court as a witness, and who on cross-examination, when she turned the witness over to Mr. Jacobs' attorneys, was asked a whole series of questions that the district court did not ask. One of those questions was, did you review any documents in preparation for your testimony here today? And his answer was, unequivocally, yes. Did he have those documents with him? No. Did he testify from the documents? No. But he did take a look at some attorney-client emails and some entries that he had made on his computer to describe what he was doing on a particular day. He reviewed these materials for the purpose of establishing a timeline for the events, not the events themselves, but a timeline for the events that were he was examined on and others were examined on when the judge ordered and convened this hearing. The hearing concluded on September the 12th. On September the 14th, 2 days later, the judge entered her decision and order sanctioning the defendants. Those sanctions had been paid, and that order is now history. It was not appealed. 2 months later, on November the 16th, Mr. Jacobs filed a motion to compel the production of documents that were reviewed by the lawyer witness for the Las Vegas Sands prior to coming to court to testify. He took the position, and he takes it here now, and it was accepted by the district court. The Nevada Revised Statute 50.125 means that once a witness looks at documents to refresh his or her recollection, those documents become discoverable. That's what Judge Gonzalez said in her order that prompted this writ petition on January the 18th, 2013. this year. She ordered the production of documents reviewed by lawyer Justin Jones under 50.125. It is that order and her application of 51.125 that brings us here today. And it poses this question. Does NRS 50.125 abrogate the privileges that are available to a party and a witness and that are preserved by Nevada Revised Statute 47.020. That statute refers to privileges including expressly the attorney-client privilege that is codified in Nevada Revised Statute 49.95. The answer to that question that I just posed, does 51.25 abrogate the privilege as expressly preserved? The answer to that question is unequivocally no. There are no cases in this courtroom saying unequivocally no, but there are a host of cases in the federal system, including the federal district court across the street in Silver Technologies, that have a similar rule of evidence, similar to 51.25, does that apply? It's federal rule of evidence 612. It is the source for the Nevada Revised Statute 51.25. So the technology observed,
what are the differences in your mind between 50.125 and FRE 612?
There's a very slight difference with respect to whether a witness reviewed documents before or after or during testimony. But 612 is the, our rule was taken from the draft of 612 that was circulated in 1971 and amended to add this one provision with respect to if justice so requires, the court can order, after conducting a balancing test, as the cases say, the production of documents that might otherwise be unavailable for privilege. But those are fact-intensive determinations. In substance, 51.25 and Federal Rule 612 are essentially the same. And we point out that among the host of cases I referred to, the courts often, as this court has suggested on occasion, pointed out that there is occasionally a conflict between Federal Rule 612 and Nevada Rule 50.125. and privilege. So what do you do in that case? Well, we come to your first question. Your question was, does 50.125 indicate a legislative intent to relax NRS 47.020 and its privilege provisions? Remember, it refers to Chapter 49, which enshrines the attorney-client privilege. The answer to that question, that first question you asked, is unequivocally, as I said with respect to the question I posed at the outset here, no. NRS 47.020 says, it doesn't suggest, it says, privileges are preserved at all stages of all proceedings, except where rules of evidence are relaxed by statute or by rule of procedure. We have one statute in this state that relaxes the rules of the rule of privilege in one instance, and that is when a judge is faced with the question of admissibility qualifications for the purposes of admissibility of the witness's testimony. But it preserves 47.060 is the statute. It preserves the privileges that are in Chapter 49, the attorney-client privilege. This is clear to us, it is, and we defer to it in our briefs. When you read the legislative subcommittee's notes, I've been up to Senator Reed as a member of that committee, and that goes back a long time. I didn't have gray hair when that bill was written, and those deliberations occurred.
Mr. Morse, can you spend about the 5 minute mark? Could you talk about the timeliness of the motion to compel? Well, I know from your point of view why you believe it wasn't timely, and Mr. Bison tells why he believes it was.
That really comes to your second question. Okay. And that is, may an adverse party inspect a privileged document used by a witness to refresh recollection while testifying? The timing of this is important. The time to file a motion to produce documents under 51.125, it's not a rule of discovery, it's a rule of evidence, was at the time this hearing occurred. That didn't take place. There was a colloquy between the court and Mr. Pisanelli, who's in court, with respect to assembling documents that were reviewed by Justin Jones, but there was no request for that. No motion was made. No recess was called so the judge could examine, if she felt it was necessary, the documents in question to determine whether they were relevant to the subject matter of what was being testified to. Mm-hmm. We say if the subject matter was being testified to is separate from what Mr. Jones said he reviewed those documents for, and that was to establish a timeline. When the hearing is over, Rule 51.125 expires. There is no witness whose credibility can be questioned by the production of documents at that point. There's no motion pending for it. This is unlike the Means case, where there was a request at trial for the production of work product that was used by the witness at the request of the state, I might add. You were on that panel, Chief Justice.
Acting Chief Justice for the same thing.
I have to address his other Chief Justice too, who got out of court. But in any event, Your Honor, my point is this. In Means, the lawyer for the client who wanted to see the notes took the notes with him to the stand. Mr. Jones didn't. The lawyer, at the request of the state in Means, testified from the notes. Mr. Jones didn't. The lawyer and the client were disputing. There isn't any lawyer-client dispute here, and nothing to weigh with respect to work product. We're looking at a dispute between adversaries. Our adversary says, although I didn't ask for the production of documents and show cause why those documents should be shown to me for inspection to test this witness's credibility, I'm going to agree with Judge Gonzalez that 50.125 really is a rule of discovery, and we should produce those now. The time to invoke this rule and to address this subject has passed.
Thank you. Mr. Morse, you had about 2 minutes left. We'll give you 3 minutes, and Tracy, would you add another minute to Mr. Bice's time? So he'll have 16 minutes for his presentation.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Todd Bice on behalf of Real Party in Interest, Stephen Jacobs. I will begin with what I actually think that the question presented for you is, and that is, does NRS 50.125 contain any exemption from its proviso that the adversary is entitled, has an entitlement, to review the documents if they are used to refresh recollection and then later claim to be privileged after having done so? We know that from Means versus State, this court concluded that the work product doctrine, which of course is a privilege, is not an exception to the inspection rights under 50.125. So the question then becomes, it seems to me, is What is the basis, therefore, for treating other forms of privilege, including all of those in Chapter 49, of which there are many, and I think it's very important that we focus on that today, as being somehow different and somehow exempt from the reach of 50.125, when there is no caveat in the statute saying such as unless otherwise exempt or anything like that, which the legislature has been prone to do from time to time. And then I would turn to the question about timing for you. The question that the court has put to us is there any specific language in 125, in 50.125, that makes these documents subject to production when there is a claim of privilege? So let me segue just slightly on this issue. In the face of the motion to compel, there was no affidavit submitted. There was no in-camera inspection. There was nothing of any substance to substantiate any claims of privilege. For example, some of these documents were attorney billing records, and there's a lot of case law that says that attorney billing records aren't privileged in the first place. But nonetheless, the district court's order turns, of course, on the assumption that these documents are privileged, and therefore it analyzes the question in the face of that, and that's how we intend to proceed. With respect to the statute, as I said, there is no exemption under it for any form of privilege. And if you look at the provisions of Chapter 49, there are a whole host of privileges. And I'd ask the court, so when you're interpreting these statutes and trying to reconcile, well, what did the legislature mean when it flat out said expressly that you had that the opponent has an entitlement to inspect the documents? Did they really not mean what they said? Did there was a really a large caveat, and in fact a gaping caveat to that requirement? Because look at what Chapter 49 includes: attorney-client privilege, accountant-client privilege, patient-psychologist privilege, doctor-patient privilege, marriage and family therapist, marital privilege, professional counselor privilege, etc. I think when you look at this statute, you have to ask yourselves, because obviously the statute applies in all contexts, not just civil cases. Look at it in the context of a criminal case. The witness means being an example. The witness is on the stand. Mm-hmm. The witness takes a document and uses the document while on the stand. Use a victim in a criminal case as an example. The victim uses the document and says, well, this is a privileged communication here with my victim advocacy, with my victim advocate, my doctor, my counselor, etc. The witness, there is typically is going to arise as the witness will say, the witness will be challenged, right? Their testimony is either altered, changed in some fashion, or being challenged. But what does the witness say? Now, my recollection has been refreshed because I looked at a document, and it's either a document that I claim now is privileged. Mm-hmm. Look at the position that
witness
is.
The witness said, I looked at the documents to refresh my memory about the timing of events in the case.
Correct.
Does it make a difference when the witness says, I look at a document to refresh my memory about a date? Thus, I look at an email for a particular date, but I haven't reviewed the rest of the email. One of the things that's concerning to me, and the reason the timing question is posed, okay, is isn't it incumbent upon counsel and the court to vet these questions at the time of the hearing so that one can determine whether or not attorney-client privilege, accountant-client privilege, and all of the other privileges might be subject to waiver? None of that vetting occurred here. We don't know whether the witness looked at the email for the purposes of refreshing his memory about the contents of the email or refreshing his memory about the date in which his participation in these events occurred. Seems to me a critical question in analyzing the application and use of 50.125.
I think that the answer to that, Justice Hardesty, is if you look at the entirety of the record, how this came up is he acknowledged that he used them to refresh his recollection. There was no testimony that he didn't read the substance of the documents and that he wasn't using...
He wasn't asked. I have a transcript right here in front of me.
I understand that. And the party here, of course, claiming the privilege has the burden of establishing the privilege. And generally speaking, at least in the federal courts, we also have the burden of establishment at what rate. So when the question is being posed to us of, well, is the
actually, the application of 5125 places the burden on the party who wants to inspect it.
Correct. And we
at the request.
Yes. And we believe that we did. And in fact, the district court cut us off and said, you're going to ask them for a meet and confer. You're going to file a motion. They're going to oppose it, and then I'm going to decide it. That process, the district court decided what that process would be. I don't believe that we can be faulted for having complied with the district court's directive on how that process would be conducted. Under the scenario that's being presented to you, and I'll come back to this timing issue, but under the scenario being presented to you, under all circumstances, then the evidentiary hearing or trial or whatever it would be would have to be halted while there's briefing, motion practice, and likely, if an adverse ruling, just as we have here, an inevitable writ proceeding that completely disrupts the entire process.
Well, it might be, but that seems to be what the rule expressly says.
I think
that you have it produced at the hearing. What's the effect of the words at the hearing?
Well, again, if you look at the purpose of the rule is to give the opponent the ability to challenge a witness's testimony that their recollection has been refreshed with respect to the document. That is the purpose of the rule. This rule also comes up, obviously, in the context of depositions, the same sort of principle, which isn't a quote-unquote hearing in the literal sense. This is an interlocutory order. I do not believe that just because the witness is now off the stand, the credibility of the witness is somehow now immune from any challenge. If it were to turn out, for example, that the documents are contradictory to what the witness's claimed recollection being refreshed was, that would provide the opponent an opportunity to either reopen the issue, move for an amendment of its sanctions order, or in any other case, to move to amend the order or to seek additional sanctions. Just because the witness gets off the stand does not place the documents and their testimony free from any criticism or any challenge. It would, I would agree with you, in the following circumstances, if it's an actual trial. If it's an actual trial and the trial ends and there's a determination, their testimony, their credibility is no longer subject to any form of judicial scrutiny unless there is a reversal and the case is sent back down. Under those scenarios, yes, I would agree that timing is critical. But when you have an interlocutory order, especially an interlocutory order that deals with allegations of litigation misconduct and deception of the court, those issues somehow do not get swept off the table simply because due to the passage of time. Those issues are ripe in the event that it turns out that the documents do not support the claimed refreshed recollection of the witness. And that's why I do not believe that the timing issue is quite as critical as it is claimed. The same issue arises in depositions, where the witness uses a deposition a deposition document during deposition and says, well, this refreshed my recollection. Well, you don't just stop everything, I apologize, you don't stop everything and say, well, we now have to have a resolution of that issue before anything else can proceed. That's not true. You will go to the court, motion practice will ensue. The party, if they claim privilege and they lose, is likely to seek writ relief. The case still proceeds, and at the time of trial, that document can be subject to discovery, and that witness's claim recollection can be challenged. And that's what the purpose of this statute is all about. Think about the context of saying that privilege is immune from the requirements of 50.125. And I think Mr. Morris has sort of confirmed this point. He uses means as an example. The witness could take a document as their script of testimony prepared by their attorney and say, well, this refreshes my recollection, but I'm allowed now to use this to testify from. Under those circumstances, are we really going to say that a claim of privilege doesn't allow you to examine the document and challenge whether or not, in fact, that document really refreshes their recollection or whether or not this is simply orchestrated testimony?
Well, I appreciate the argument, but my question really is whether privilege is at issue depends on the extent to which the witness has inspected the document and the purpose for which the witness has inspected it, doesn't it?
whether or not the document, no, I don't think so. As I understand your question, just slightly, and maybe I'm not understanding it clearly, but I don't think the answer to that is. You have an entitlement to inspect the document, to challenge the witness's claim that the document refreshed their recollection. Because, and look at the scenario that typically happens. The witness is typically challenged. The witness is typically challenged. Mm-hmm. And the way that the witness deflects the challenge is to say, let's say that they gave a prior inconsistent statement or something like that. They're being challenged. Well, their defense mechanism is to say, well, my recollection was refreshed by looking at X. Well, then you're entitled to see X to see whether or not they can really claim credibility that their recollection was refreshed, or are they simply fabricating an excuse for having altered their story? And that, it doesn't matter whether or not the nature of the communication was privileged or not under those types of circumstances. So when you
look at... I'm trying to rephrase the question.
I apologize.
It's burden this, but it seems to me it's critical to determine whether or not the door is open to a waiver of the privilege. If the witness is asked, mm-hmm. would you do X on a certain date? And the witness says, yes. How do you know that? I know that because I looked at an email that's dated that date, and that refreshed my memory. And it's a 45-page email that contains a whole bunch of attorney-client privilege stuff. The question is, are you entitled, as the cross-examiner, to look at the date of the email, or are you entitled to look at the whole of the email?
I think that the statute...
And here, looking at Mr. Jones' testimony, it's unclear to me as to what he was going to do, what was refreshed. Was it the dates that the emails contained, or the contents that refreshed his testimony?
Well, our reading of the testimony is he acknowledged that he went back and he looked at emails about certain dates, and he looked at billing records about certain dates, but because those emails pertain to certain events, and those certain events were the reviewing of documents and whether or not they had disclosed those to the court. Now, we believe that the record is quite clear that they did not disclose those to the court, and as we have put in our brief, and as I believe that the district court found, quite clearly, they were not disclosed, and in fact, we believe it was a concerted effort to conceal that information from both us and from the district court, mm-hmm. and that it wasn't some sort of inadvertence or misunderstanding. And that's why those emails, I believe, are quite important on that issue. We have litigants and their counsel who weren't disclosing information to the court, and in fact, were outright denying where documents and evidence was located at, claiming that they were justified in that course of conduct. The court, I don't believe, can look the other way on that sort of an event. So when you look at what he was testifying about, he said he looked at particular emails because those emails were pertaining directly to the issues that were in front of the court. Now, if a party wants to claim, I didn't look at the substance of the email, the statute provides a mechanism for dealing with that. You have to give the document to the court, and you can direct to the court, and it's your burden. This is where I somewhat disagree. It's not our burden, it's their burden, just because what it says is, I believe it's in sub 2, if it is claimed, well, who's making the claim? The person with the document. If it is claimed that the writing contains matters not related to the subject matter of the testimony, the judge shall examine the writing in chambers and excise any portions thereof. The party making the claim is the one who has to raise that. Not the party seeking the document, because they don't know. And that's why I believe that the statute specifies that it was their obligation, if they wanted to claim that these documents were somehow, the substance of them was not something Mr. Jones looked at, they had to make that claim, they had to provide the documents in camera to the court to look at them, and then say that they could be excised. That wasn't done here. And I would submit to the court, again, now you see I just have a minute here left. When you look at this statute, you're being asked to graft what I would submit is a hole through which you will drive a semi-truck. Because if privilege under Chapter 49 is exempt from this requirement, this will become just the perfect perjury tool. Every witness now who gets confronted, all they have to say is, my record, yes, I testified to a different version earlier, but my recollection's been refreshed, and I'm relying upon a privileged document as the source of the refreshed recollection, and you're not permitted to see it and challenge the veracity of this. This also applies in criminal cases. Can you imagine the consequences to the confrontation clause of a victim being allowed to take the stand and say, well, yes, I'm changing my testimony, but it's based on a refreshed recollection from a privileged document, and you're not entitled to even know whether the document even exists. You're not entitled to confront the witness to show that there's no way that document is refreshing your recollection, that they're merely fabricating.
Mr. Bice, take one more minute, please, and we'll give Mr. Morrison another minute. Please focus on the timeliness issue so we can get your point of view on that.
Thank you. On the timing issue, again, we come back to this point. This statute is a statute that is designed to find the truth. And witnesses are permitted to testify that part of their testimony is based upon a refreshed recollection. You're entitled to access to the document to challenge that. Yes, I will acknowledge that in most circumstances like that, if it's at a trial, it's going to be at the trial and the court will decide it on the spot. But if it's at an evidentiary type hearing or a deposition, something that is interlocutory in the case, then most prudent district court judges are going to want briefing, they're going to hear an argument on it, and they're not going to hold up the entire case while they decide those questions, because the question of involving privilege, people are going to come and visit all of you about writ petitions as well. So it's a far more prudent process that the district court engaged in here, which was to invite briefing so that it could decide the question, and if we're right, the question is, because it's interlocutory, it's still open to the court.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the time.
Thank you. Mr. Morris, you have 4 minutes now in rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Very popular one. Thank you. Mr. Sardisney and members of the court, I think it's worthwhile pointing out when you look at the transcript of the hearing on the final day of the final hearing day, September 12th, the whole line of inquiry with respect to the documents began with Mr. Pisanelli's remark that your testimony with respect to dates appears to be precise. And the response to that was, yes. And he then followed that up with saying, did you look at any documents to refresh your recollection? And the witness answered, yes, with respect to establishing a timeline. Not for the purpose, he didn't say for the purpose of, and he was not asked questions with respect to the purpose of looking at those documents for any reason other than to establishing the timeline. So I think that pretty much shows us that the date was at issue. But what's important here, I think, is this. The district judge was there and heard all of this. The district judge didn't say, wait a second, I'm judging credibility here. This is my hearing. Let's have a break here, and you assemble those emails and these time entries, and let me take a look at them, and I'll see whether or not these are something that has to be produced because they're relevant to the subject matter of what I'm inquiring into here.
Is witness Jones' credibility still at issue in these proceedings?
Pardon me?
Is witness Jones' credibility still at issue in further proceedings?
No, it didn't seem to be.
Pardon me?
It didn't seem to be. No one challenged his credibility. No one. And when the judge wrote her decision.
I'm talking about further proceedings. An order was entered in the context of this proceeding, but is witness Jones still subject to further testimony and further proceedings in this case? This case isn't over.
I don't believe so. Okay. No, he's a lawyer for a party. He's not going to be a witness. This is an exception to the rule of
me now.
Hmm?
He might be now.
Well, he could be. That's true. But I don't believe there's any contention, and it's not in the papers, that he is going to be a witness in the future. In point of fact, if he is a witness in the future, we ought to call him and subpoena him and then run through this 50.125 proceeding again, they can do so. The 51.25, as you point out, and as you suggest by the questions that you posed, particularly question number 2, addresses timing.
whom is the request for documents and the potential production of privileged documents an issue? And that is while the witness is testifying with respect to documents as in means that he had with him and testified from, or with respect to documents, and this outlines the distinction between 5125 and 612.
So you're saying regardless of what type of hearing it is, whether it's a trial or a pretrial hearing,
yes,
it has to apply to that particular hearing.
Yes.
Deposition too?
Pardon?
You mean deposition too?
Would it apply in deposition? I mean, should production of documents? No, that's just part of 4706 says, the privilege is preserved at all points in the proceeding. So the witness says at a deposition that I looked at documents and someone says, this and later, fine, I can do that later. And then if the witness thereafter is called at trial, well, I suppose you can ask additional questions. But the deposition example is just one stop along the way in trial proceedings, in trial or testimony.
Keith, I have a question again.
Of course,
Mr. Morris, one of the things that seems to be key here is the claim or assertion that Mr. Jones looked at documents only to establish a timeline. I don't think there's any dispute that that's what the testimony was. My question is, if you're looking at an email entry, you can see the date without ever going into the body of the email. So in this case, how can we not say that the subject matter contained within that email may be something that the other side needs to see, when in fact it sounds to me like Mr. Jones had to at least open that email to calculate his timeline? And I know that's a convoluted
question. How can you tell? You can tell if the witness were asked questions about, for example, well, what was the subject of, not what was said, what was the subject of the email that we reviewed for the purpose of establishing timeline? That question wasn't asked. The judge was not presented with, and counsel could not ask the judge, absent a question like that, to examine the documents in camera, for example, to see if there are privileged statements in there that the witness is testifying from, that would have to yield to, that would have to yield to the privilege preserved at all stages of all proceedings at 47 or 60.
Thank you
very much, Mr. Morris. Thank you for excellent arguments and briefing this with the writ petition. The matter will be taken under submission. I invite counsel just to stay at their same tables. So